Accession number 9434, reel 18.
Mr. Bill Collins, reel 18. Did you have any idea of what the actual situation was in Novorossiysk when you were there?
Well, it must have, we knew it must be pretty grim because we were taking aboard people to get away from the Bolshevists, you see, and in any case, the British force that was there was only a handful of men and a couple of guns and about two aeroplanes. It was never of the slightest use in keeping back any attack at all. And they gradually retired and evacuated Novorossiysk. And unfortunately for future Russian relations, they set fire to all the stuff they couldn't take on board in the port, which would have been very useful to the Russians, tea and food and things like that. All they couldn't take on board, they set fire to.
Did you have any sympathies with either side you were in?
None at all, no. No, a soldier, a regular soldier, a professional soldier, I don't think ever has sympathies with either side.
You weren't interested in the politics?
No,
of the
politics didn't interest me in the slightest. No. All that interested me was what I'd been trained for to do and the carrying of it out.
So you left Novorossiysk. Did you stay in Novorossiysk long? Did you leave the ship?
No, I never left the ship in Novorossiysk. Never left the ship.
What impression did you get of the refugees?
Well, I thought that they'd had a pretty rough time, and they were glad to get away. You see, they would all have been for the chop, I think. If they were all sorts, there were Georgians, Armenians, one man who spoke English perfectly, and all sorts. We dropped them at Constantinople.
So, you got to... After Constantinople, where did you go then?
After Constantinople, we went back to Gibraltar.
Who were you carrying this time?
We were carrying very, very little. Just a few troops. We were carrying some of the troops... Which were the early evacuees of the Novorossiysk position. We had, there was some artillerymen and a few infantrymen and a few details who had been ordered to leave, you see.
So you brought them from Novorossiysk?
Yes, Novorossiysk. And one of them, an artillery lieutenant, I had the arduous job, he'd become epileptic. And I had the arduous job of having to sit in this cabin with him all day, and when he was in an advanced stage of epilepsy, and I had to sit in and grab his wrists every time he went off to stop him from damaging himself, you see. And he was a very bad case, and I had that all on my hands all the way to England. I never forget that. But I had full of sympathy with him. I noticed that the medical officer said GPI, which is general paralysis of the insane, which was a nasty... He was in the last stages of epilepsy, you see. So I had a very nasty passage back home.
Would that be caused by his war experience or just be a family?
I couldn't tell you what the cause of it was, but he had it, poor chap.
So from Gibraltar, where did you go?
From Gibraltar? We reached Gibraltar on the 31st of December. And I remember I had to put this artillery officer in charge of one of my men with injunctions not to leave him, sit next to him all the time, and I explained to him what to do, how to get his wrists, just hold them gently down so they couldn't move. They damage themselves, they struggle and damage themselves, you see. So just restrain him gently what to do. And I went up to the hospital in Gibraltar, climbed up the hill. I went up there to get some fresh supplies of the anti-influenza medicine, you see. Everyone was being treated with this anti-influenza medicine at the time as a preventative.
What was this anti-influenza medicine?
I didn't know what it was composed of. It was a mild, it seemed to me like a mild anti-cough mixture, but I couldn't tell you what it was composed of.
Did you think it was effective?
But I think it was effective, yes. It was effective if the virus wasn't too strong. But it had begun to peter out a bit by then, see, 1920, the virus. And I remember, I left the hospital with my medical supplies, and I wanted some bandages too, and I went to the Army Service Corps canteen, and I had a couple of beers. And you know, by the time I got to the ship, I was woozy. I'd only had a couple of bottles of beer, and I felt quite woozy. And I climbed up the companion ladder, up onto the ship, and I was swaying, and a friendly Sergeant Major of the Army Service Corps saw me, and caught me, and took me and laid me down in my bunk. And I lay there, and I heard all the hooters in the army, in the harbour, signal the end of the year, the new year in. They were hooting, all the noise was terrific, all the ship's hooters were going and signalling the new year in. And the next day, I felt a bit like, I couldn't make out why a couple of bottles of beer should do that to me. It never happened before. And so it was then I learned that the beer in Gibraltar was twice as strong as a beer anywhere else, because it had to stand the journey from England, you see, in the ships. It had to be strong to stand the journey. And I was talking to the bosun on the Kursk, and I said to him this, I said, this is that it nearly set me, put me down. He said, yes, it is strong. I said, I said, bosun, you know Gibraltar well, don't you? Oh, yes, he said. He was an old man, and he'd been on the Lusitania when it was the crack ship of the world. And he said, I said, what do they do in Gibraltar? I couldn't see any activity. He said, you want to know the imports and exports of Gibraltar? I said, yes. Well, he says, they import Bass, and they export the empty bottles. I thought that was a very good comment on the imports and exports of Gibraltar. Anyway, we left Gibraltar, and we sailed up round through the bay again, or different bay this time. It was a quiet bay compared to the last one. You see, we got a following wind. And we landed at Plymouth. And we got the band. I remember the band. There was a band to greet us there, playing Where Are the Boys of the Old Brigade? And I thought myself, yes, where are they? And we got ashore, and we took a train. We were going back to Aldershot. And we took a train which took us near to Bristol, and then back to Reading, and the train stopped at Reading for the night. So I got out, my chaps out, marched them to the barracks of the Royal 1st Battalion, the Royal Berkshire Regiment, which is headquarters in Reading, and I begged a bed for all of us for the night, which was very gladly granted, and we had a comfortable night as guests of the 1st Battalion Royal Berks. Following day, back to Aldershot. Hadn't been there 5 minutes. I was given an order, prepare yourself to go back to Germany. I thought myself, they're not going to give me much chance of having a look at England, you see. And so I then had an assignment to join number 37 Casualty Clearing Station at Cologne. And they were quartered in Cologne itself, but they were due to go to Danzig.
Was that 36 or 37?
Well, I think it was 37, but it may have been 36 just at this, but I know it was one or the other.
So now, you sound as if the resentment was starting to build up a little here about being constantly posted away from England. Would that be fair to say you were resenting it a little now?
I was feeling it a little bit. I thought so. I've been looking forward to having a bit of English scenery after the 4.5 years of the Western Front, you see, but it was not to be. But anyway, I was a regular, and you see, you carry out orders and you go where you're sent. And I had no open resentment about it at all. I thought myself, well, that's the posting, and I carried out. So when I got to 37, I think it was 37 Casualty Clearing Station, when I got there, I found myself that they were assembling to go to Danzig. And I found myself given the job as running the orderly room.
So you weren't, that it was not. You weren't staff sergeant here then?
I was staff sergeant.
Oh, you were staff sergeant.
I was staff sergeant then, and I was given the job of running the orderly room. In other words, I became the CO's right-hand man in the orderly room, doing all the returns of the strength, returns for rations, all the notifications, everything, all the paperwork I was in charge of.
So you were now away from the medical side.
I was now completely away from the medical side of the Corps. And I, for the rest of my service, I became a glorified clerk.
Well, what did you think about that?
Well, I didn't mind. It was I had two ladies of the commissioned. They were treated as commissioned ladies, as assistants in the office, and to do the typing, and any job I assigned to them, and they were both very good and very nice, and it was quite pleasant. The CO was Colonel Rowe. He was quite tolerant, and. He was tolerant to a point of humour, because one night he came into the office in Danzig and caught me reading King's Regulations, you know, by which the army is run. And he said, "What are you reading?" I said, "King's Regulations, sir." He laughed. He says, "How amusing!" He says, he was quite good. He was quite good, and the officers were quite good. The regimental sergeant major was a first-class chap. Altogether, I enjoyed my stay in Danzig.
Were you in billets again?
No, we were in barracks. We took over the barracks of the Deathshead Hussars and turned it into a hospital in a place called Langfur. There's a suburb of Danzig called Langfur, and this is very interesting. Danzig Langfur, we took over the Deathshead Hussars barracks, turned it into a hospital, and in my walks around Langfur, I discovered that nearly all the names of the Germans there began with Mac. I couldn't understand this, and I remembered that one of the most famous generals in the German army was Field Marshal von Mackensen, and he claimed that he was a Royal Steward. He claimed that he was a royal steward and entitled to the British throne, in fact. And they were all Macs, and so I found out afterwards that they were the descendants of Scottish raiders back in the 800 years before, and their descendants had taken over this particular area of the Danzig harbour and interland, and kept their Mac in front of their names.
So what was your daily routine then?
Well, the daily routine was the usual, all correspondence, returns of rations and returns of personnel.
Hours would you start? When would you start?
Oh, we'd start at 7, up past 7, 8 o'clock in the morning, and finish at about 4 in the afternoon. Colonel Rowe never finished at 4 o'clock. I could have gone off any time after 4, but as a matter of fact, I stayed in the office because I could read there. I could read a book there, and if the phone rang, there was always someone to answer it. You see, I didn't like it to depend on someone else if we were rung up by superior officers or our headquarters. You see, and one night. I had an urgent telephone call, a gunner, serious, abdominal pains, tremendous, doubled up. And we sent a motor ambulance down and brought this unfortunate gunner to the hospital. The doctor, Captain Charles, who was on duty, took one look at him, felt his tummy, and said, "Look, Mr. Staff Sergeant," he says, "rush around," he says, "to Major Curtis. You know where he's billeted?" I said, "Yes." "Rush around and tell him," he said, "I've got an appendicitis case here. Could he come immediately?" And I went round and roused Major Curtis from bed. It was late at night, about 11 o'clock. Got him out of bed, and he came round and performed the operation on the gunner, and I watched every minute of it. I watched every bit of that appendicitis operation, and it was a nasty one. But it took an hour, which was pretty long. And in the end, he was all tidied up and put away, But, you know, in 6 weeks that fella wanted to play football. He was so tough. He recovered and wanted to play football.
After your years of experience, would you have had the knowledge to do a piece of surgery like that or anything like that?
No. I knew where the organs were, but you see, it's experience. The young student surgeons who carry out such an operation, first of all, would do it under the immediate supervision of a highly experienced surgeon. They would never be left alone to do the job.
Now, well, you've only finished your day's work. What sort of recreations would you have?
None whatever. Except for one occasion. On one occasion, I went to the Opera House. At the Opera House in Danzig, and I saw Ambroise Thomas' Mignon, opera, French opera, Mignon, played in German, and very well too, and beautifully played, beautifully sung, and I enjoyed that. And the only other amusement was we used to drop into a cafe close by the barracks, drop into a cafe where they had a small orchestra who would play any tune we asked them to play, you see, and we had a bit of amusement that way. Had a bit of cup of coffee and a biscuit or something, and heard them play some music. That was the only entertainment we had.
Now, were you aware of the purpose of you being in Danzig and what was going on about the borders and plebiscite?
Oh, yes.
Could you explain what you thought was happening?
When the war ended, Danzig was claimed by both Germany and Poland. You must remember that after hundreds of years of subjection, Poland had at last become a nation again. They had been a subject race for hundreds of years, and they at last became an independent nation under the Treaty of Versailles. And they claimed the port of Danzig as theirs. Well, the population of Danzig was roughly 50% German and 50% Polish. And of course, the adjacent territory was also similarly split. And the difficulty of finding a borderline was obvious. And so they had what was called a plebiscite, an election to decide where the German and Polish border should be. And the force that we were there with, three battalions of infantry and some artillery, we were there to keep order between the Poles and the Germans, because they to put it quite bluntly, they hated each other's guts. And so we were there to keep order, and the casualty clearing station, the hospital, was there to treat any casualties that might occur as a result of it.
Was there any trouble?
No, none at all. Only what I call slight, you know, brawls. That's all. But nothing that called for the intervention of troops.
How did the Poles and the Germans treat you when you were in their town?
The Germans were East Germans, and they were aloof. The Poles, of course, were as friendly as they could be. They had got themselves a nation. They were a nation again by the grace of the English, French, and American troops. But the Germans were rather aloof, except for the high ups. I mean, the Burgomaster of Danzig, Count Salom, I found quite easy to deal with when I wanted something for the hospital.
Now, as you were, we're talking about 1920 now, and obviously 1920, you began to come up for the end of your service as a regular.
Yes,
could you explain what was going through your mind and the date that it became due and such like?
Yes, I was due to leave the army on the September the 30th, 1920, and I put in August. In August 1920, I put in an application that I wasn't going to renew my service after the 30th September. I notified the headquarters of the medical services in Danzig that I was going home for discharge at the end of my 7 years. You see, and then They tried to dissuade me otherwise, but I wasn't having any. I didn't want to. I wanted to go home.
Could you explain that? Why?
I'd had 7 years, and if they'd given me some home service after the war, it would have been different. But I kept being shunted away out of England, whereas I wanted to be at home for at least a year if I could. You see, so as I was shunted, I feared that if I'd renewed my service, I might be shunted to any old place, you see. So I decided to go. And eventually, I got on a train in Danzig with a Sergeant Major of the Royal Army Service Corps, or the Army Service Corps it was, and we were both due to be discharged. And we went down by train to Berlin, from Danzig to Berlin, stayed a night at the Hotel Adlon, and then went on to Cologne, and then to Dunkirk, and went then by ship to Dover. So, and thence to Aldershot.
Did you go to your depot at Crookham? Did you go to the new depot?
I went to the new depot at Crookham, yes. And the first greeting from the Sergeant Major, Marsh, I remembered his name last night, Marsh, was, he looked at my Staff Sergeant's chevrons, and he said, take them down, you see, because I was acting Staff Sergeant. My substantive rank was corporal, which I'd been promoted to on the 12th of December 1914. See, to become a sergeant in the Royal Army Medical Corps, regular army, you have to be a chemist and pass the chemist's examination. And of course, I had no chance to pass them. I mean, when the war broke out, that stopped any studies that I could have made, you see. So my substantive rank was corporal. But anyway, he said, take them down. So I became a corporal again. And in the corporal's mess there, I became acquainted with the portrait of the famous writer of thrillers, Edgar Wallace, who was a corporal in the Royal Army Medical Corps in the South African War. There was his picture was on the wall there. But when he said, take them down, you see. And then coming close to my discharge date, about the 1st of September, I was tackled again by the CO of the depot. And why didn't I sign on again, you see, continuing the Corps? And I said, no, I said, I've been shunted about a lot since the war, and I want now to be certain of at least 1 or 2 years at home in England. And he resigned himself to the fact that I was going, but the Sergeant Major had one last attack. He tackled me one day, he says, why aren't you signing on, he says, all your experience, valuable to the Corps? I said, yes, sir. But I said, what's going to happen if I sign on? He says, you'll get 3 months' leave. I said, yes, that's very good. I shall enjoy that. I said, but where do I go when I come back from 3 months' leave? He says, you'll go for 4 years to Mesopotamia. I said, no, sir, no, thank you very much. That's what I wanted to know. He said, I shan't sign on. And he turned at me and looked at me and says, what are you, he says, a soldier or a glowworm? And then that was the note on which I ended my army service after 7 years.
How did you feel about that? Do you think that was...
I was hurt to think that I was called a glowworm after having served in the front line and been wounded and blown unconscious, wounded, and got a good name for the Corps in the 1st Cavalry Brigade. All the sergeant majors knew, all the men in the regiments knew me. I was always there when I was wanted, and even the officers, even the staff officers knew me. And that's why I was given that job of that message that day. And then to be called a glowworm, I thought was a bit thick.
Now, Marsh, I believe, hadn't been to France.
Don't think he'd been to France at all. I don't think he'd left the depot during the war. I wouldn't be sure, but I don't think he had, because when I got back there from Danzig, I noticed that one of the drill instructors was still drill instructing, that the adjutant was still there, same adjutant, and they hadn't apparently left the depot. Mind you, the instructors there who stayed on, they've got to have good instructors. I mean, the better the instructor, the better your force is going to be. And so there's nothing against them that they didn't go to France. They were doing a valuable job instructing men to come out and work with us out there.
But it was because... So it didn't really make it worse that Marsh hadn't been to France?
Oh, no, it didn't make it worse. I mean, Altrincham said no. He was a magnificent footballer. Before the war, in my short time before the war, I watched him play some wonderful games for the Depot Football 11. Because we got into the semi-final of the Amateur Cup one year, and he was a magnificent centre-half. But Office had puffed him up a bit.
What was the actual procedure of your demobilisation when it arrived on the 30th?
Well, I got a month's leave, and dressed up. I handed my uniform in and documents, and I was given a civilian suit, which was quite good, and a pay slip to cash at the post office, and then, of course, I signed on for the reserve. I signed on for 5 years in the Royal Army Medical Corps Reserve. In other words, if there was an outbreak of hostilities or a national incident of any kind, I became available. I had to leave whatever job I was doing and get back into uniform again. I was a first priority reserve, you see.
Before we come to civilian life, did that entail any training? Or any, you know, would you have to go to a camp or...
No, none at all, nothing whatever. I went straight out into civilian life.
So there was being a reserve didn't entail anything else other than that responsibility?
Nothing at all. Just they're available when wanted, you see. I was I'd qualified myself on the battlefield and that was they knew that.
So you came out of the army. What did you have to go to? Where did you go?
Nothing, I went home. I went home.
South Croydon.
I went home with Central Croydon, yes. Central Croydon. They moved to Central Croydon, my parents. I went home to Central Croydon, I didn't bother about getting a job until the beginning of December. I had September, October, no, I had 3 months good holiday, and then I set about getting a job. And by great good luck, I'd been writing some stuff during the war. I'd applied my writing talents to writing. I'd written a story and I wrote descriptions of the trenches at night time and one thing and another during the war, and they were published in newspapers. And so I went to a gentleman who I will ever thank and revere, because he was a very great friend to me, Sir Thomas Vansittart of Bowater, Lord Mayor of London. And I went to see him, and he said, well, he says, you're back again. I'd been employed by him, you see, before the war. And he said, you're back again. He said, I don't know what. He said, what are you going to do? I said, well, I want to get into the press. And he wrote me out a card to the daily editor of the daily, to the manager, general manager of the Daily Graphic. He said, take it round. He said, see what you can do. And his introduction, they took me on straight away as a clerk in the advertisement department. I was ready to take anything, you see, to get to work again. And so I started on the Daily Graphic, and I worked on the press until 1939, with an interval away for 6 years running Radio Luxembourg, and for 3 years running Radio Luxembourg. And then when the war broke out, I went back to the Golden British Picture Corporation, which ran Luxembourg, and stayed in the film business until I retired in 1990.